Maboff.
My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. This is Scammapalooza. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. And if you do enjoy the show, why not head to iTunes and leave a review? Just like Kitty Mayhem, who said, "Brilliant podcast. Nicholas is a wonderful interviewer. His skills evidence as he chats with all sorts of different people, from magicians to journalists. Worth listening to for the anti-scam and magician info as for the guest stories. Can't recommend this pod highly enough. Smiley face, exclamation mark, star, 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 star." Boom. That is the most emojis I have ever gotten. Thank you very much, Kitty Mayhem. So you can join Kitty Mayhem on iTunes and leave a review. Also, I'm very excited to announce that Scammapalooza Live is coming in January 2017. On the 19th of January, I'm heading to the Bella Union in Melbourne, where we're going to have an entire evening of Scammapalooza Live. This probably won't be recorded, so if you would like to see the show, you do need to get along. The lineup is already taking shape. Two people who are going to be there, Dom Chambers, an extraordinary magician with something like 30 million views on Facebook, is going to be performing live, as well as Ben McKenzie, who you might remember from the episode about small-time criminals. He's going to be running a cool con artist deception game live on stage. So just two of the acts we're going to have. We're also going to have scientists, storytellers, live acts, interactive games, questions from the audience, everything you love about the podcast, live on stage, Bella Union, January the 19th. Head to conman.com.au to find out about getting tickets for the event. Now, on with the show. There are no two films in the con artist genre less alike than Focus and I Love You, Philip Morris. One is a complete work of fiction, the other is unbelievable but true. One is slick and cool, the other bright and wacky, filled with moments of slapstick and raw humanity. One features a conventional Hollywood romance, the other features two men falling in love while sharing a prison cell. And yet, both films share the same creators, Glenn Ficarra and John Requia. On this episode of Scammapalooza, Martin Dunlop and I put these two very, very different movies head-to-head to see which one comes out on top. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. So, Martin Dunlop, I'm going to call you a film guy. I don't want to call film critic. Do you like film critic?
It's not the main thing that I do.
I used to host a radio show on community radio called Hot Buttered Popcorn, which was a review program, and I just felt like, what does my opinion count for? Nothing. Who cares what I think?
Yeah.
No one.
No, it's a very... And it's a dying industry. Like, the studios dislike it more and more as time goes on that it happens at all. They would happily have no critics come to the screen. Just do an article about the production so everyone's excited. And then when it comes out, shut up about what you think of it.
Yep.
I think... yeah, and newspapers don't... not paying critics anymore, I understand.
Really?
Yeah, they're sacking them. Left and right.
That said, the idea of having one person whose job it is to arbitrarily decide the ranking of a film on a scale of 1 to 5 and provide no real analysis.
It's consumer advice, I guess.
Yeah.
I think you can say whether or not, like if you go to a film and you think, I literally, and your response is, I slept through that whole, like every scene of that was very boring, then I think you can say that to other people who are thinking about going to see a film.
Yeah.
It's like, don't spend your money on this particular
film. That's not exactly a skilled profession. Do you know what I mean?
That aspect
of film criticism isn't really something that requires a lot of, like, that film was bad, that film was good, that film was okay. Anyone can do that job. And now we have website aggregators to do it for us. So are we going to review these films today?
We're not really, I don't think.
No.
I think, look, if we can get it done right off the top, I quite liked both of them.
Me too.
I really enjoyed the two films we're doing, I Love You, Philip Morris and Focus.
Yes.
By the directing team of Surreptitiously Checks Wikipedia. by the directing team of Glenn Ficarra and John Requa. They both made these films. This one in I Love You, Philip Morris in 2009 and Focus in 2015.
And they are both con artist films, which is why we're looking at them. And they are both by the same director, which is what I find most fascinating. Because aside from that, there is very little that these two movies have in common. They have an unconventional romance at their center.
Yeah.
I mean, by Hollywood standards.
They do.
A 48-year-old man hooking up with a 26-year-old woman is not...
Oh, yeah, it's a very noticeable difference.
Yeah.
Age difference. But my friend said he was watching the film Focus. This is Will Smith and Margot Robbie have 22 years difference.
Yeah, something
age
like
difference.
That.
And my friend said he was watching, I was trying to figure out what's wrong. And then he said, I realized Margot Robbie is 6 years younger than I am. That's the problem.
Yeah.
The dynamic that I thought about after I looked up the directors was these guys were both writers on the cartoon Angry Beavers. And I actually thought that in the kind of the sassiness and the snappiness of the dialogue in both films, I thought that actually seemed to be a connecting factor, that characters in, there's a very certain kind of comedy writing that that's in both of them, even though one's a very stylish cool movie and the other one's a sort of more
mad
freewheeling indie drama thing. Yeah.
Yeah, it did. They both have that kind of fast-paced, snappy dialogue that you've come to expect from late 90s Nickelodeon cartoons.
Yeah, no, I think there is that's a real thing.
There's a real Hey Arnold
vibe
to it.
Yeah, they never, at no point do any of the main characters chew through a log or dam a river, but it is, I can still feel the Angry Beavers
influence
relationship.
On their
the
work.
Brothers fight, they fall apart, they get back together at the end.
And these two guys also wrote Bad Santa and the upcoming Bad Santa 2, and they wrote Cats and Dogs, that awful cats versus dogs
movie.
Children's film movie. We'll call it a movie.
Which is one of those weird instances where that came out, a film that people saw and kind of, whatever, forgot, and then 10 years later there was a sequel out of nowhere for a film. No one... Apparently there are a lot of questions left unanswered by Cats and Dogs. Do they really like each other? Is it really at war?
Yeah. Who can tell?
I've heard it's the Empire Strikes Back of that series.
Yes, it is. We're crossing our fingers for an origin prequel to that one.
Yeah.
We can also see there's a massive difference in the way in which these two movies were released. Because I Love You, Philip Morris, came out 2009. Couldn't get an American release for a long time. It had an international, a minor sort of art house international release, and earned back its budget. It had a $15 million budget. It made that back in a very, very short time period overseas. People rushed out to see it because it was a new Jim Carrey movie. Ewan McGregor as well, you know, is in it. And so people, what's this? We'll go and see it. Got great reviews, won some awards. And then finally it got a grudging release in a handful of cinemas in the US and earned a couple of million dollars more. So it made just under $20 million on a $15 million budget.
Yeah.
Focus, on the other hand, $50 million to make and made...
$159 million profit.
Yeah.
But it's hard, like when you get into these numbers with film studios, it is very hard to figure out exactly if they made or lost money.
Yeah.
Those are the actual numbers. Specifically, I'm thinking about Focus. Like, I Love You, Philip Morris. It seems like that might be quite accurate because of its difficulties getting distribution. It's possible they actually ended up only being able to spend $15 million on the production because there was no real marketing push behind it and stuff like that. Whereas Focus, it was a major studio release that was on billboards and bus signs and stuff, so they could have actually spent a lot more than that. $50 million they're telling everyone.
Yeah, but we have to admit that the big... We could put it down to it being an indie film and being a biopic and being unconventional and quirky, but it really, it's got to come down to the fact that Jim Carrey is gay.
He's a gay character.
He's a gay character. Yeah.
And it's a gay love story.
Gay love story. And it's not a... is Will and Grace still a reference for sanitized gay couples? You know, the sort of, like, it's a... You know, it's not.
That's a fair one.
That's a fair. Yeah, yeah. It's not a sort of family friendly depiction of.
Yeah, there are relatively graphic scenes.
Yeah,
of how graphic do you want to go on in the explanation on the podcast? The one that I liked and thought was a kind of funny little throwaway is Ewan McGregor is unseen blowing Jim Carrey's character on a boat and leans over the side and spits it out. And Jim Carrey's character says, "No, you don't love me."
Yeah.
Which is a very cute little moment between a couple. Like it's, but you can imagine someone who's more used to, say, Bruce Almighty walking out of the cinema at that point, maybe.
Yeah, not being on board with...
Not
with
even out of homophobia, just out of, like...
Not wanting to
disgust.
Something graphically sexual. I don't know. That was the reason that I think the media liked to say this film was, you know, was the little film that could, because, you know, look how great it is and look how much everyone loves it and look how people will go and see it when it's in theaters, but the studios are scared because it shows a gay couple.
And apparently they were, like, in order to get distribution, the studios wanted to cut a lot of the sex scenes from it or any references to it because they felt like that was going to hurt its numbers. But in actual release, in the cinemas, it did fine.
Yeah. I think that it is one of those things where a movie like this is never going to get huge audiences, so why not just put out the best possible film you can and hope you get an audience?
Well, maybe it could. I mean, I can't... it's hard to get into the science of this box office stuff, but I'm just thinking about if... There are certain, like, really big indie hits, the sort of Little Miss Sunshines and the Trainspotting, you know, back in the 90s. Mm. Like, it could have pulled off something like that. You don't know, but it would have been a risk either way. Like, the bigger possible outcome was they were just going to lose whatever they put into it.
Yeah. So, the... you know, the big differences are obviously budget, box office return, critical acceptance, in that this film is sort of loved by the critics, and Focus has got a fairly meh response. People have said, yeah, it's fine. And in fact, this I Love You, Philip Morris has become a cult film over the years and people remember it fondly, whereas very few people remember Focus, even though it only came out a couple of years ago. Last year, I think.
Yeah.
So it's clearly very, very different films. Let's go through them both, and we won't. I think we should avoid. We'll talk about them in detail, but let's not talk about the endings of both films because we've had a lot of listeners who haven't seen haven't always seen films that we talk
about. It's very hard though because this is with Contract movies. The spoiler's sort of the point. Like, that's where they reveal what the film's actually been about all along, you know, often. Like, not in the case of both of these movies, I'd say, but, you know, it's still a very important piece of the puzzle.
All right, well, how about we'll get all the way through, and then at the very end, we'll have a little gap. And then we'll have a little spoiler bit at the end to talk about the ending, so that people who haven't seen the film can enjoy the episode, and then we can have a little spoiler bit on the end that we'll talk actually about the endings. Because we talked in great detail about Nightmare Alley, and we had people... It was a 1950s noir thriller, and we talked about it in great detail, and the listeners said they got more and more excited about the film the more we went on, and reached a point where they well, now I don't really need to see the movie because you've spoiled it. So that's always the problem that you have with this.
No, we'll acquiesce to their, you know, demands.
To their demands. They're listeners.
You're endlessly demanding listeners.
Sarah Baggs, who was on the Cottingley Fairy episode, and also hosts It's a Duck Blur, thinks that the listeners of this podcast should be the scammer. We should call them scammer-paloozas.
Oh,
which is like,
that's real mean. I like
kind
it.
Of mean. Yeah. So I should be starting each episode with greeting scammer-paloozas.
Yeah. Look, if the presidential election have taught us nothing else, it's the people do actually respond quite well to contempt. So,
political satire.
I'm the worst. I hate myself.
So, Focus is a... To me, it felt like an old-school Cary Grant movie in terms of story and characters, but then with a very slick casino facade layered over the top. It was, you know, bright light. It was very... It felt like it was trying to... all of the scenes kind of appear in this very slick, contrived... commercial environments, so things like hotels, fancy hotels in Mardi Gras, sporting events and racetracks and everything about the film.
Yeah, no, very, very and slick. At no point does it ever subvert that, I think. There's no moment where, like, it shows, like, the opening shots are, like, this beautifully, like, skylit, neon-lit Manhattan. And there's no moment in the film where you see something really fancy and beautiful or whatever, and then they cut to something very grim and horrible happening.
No.
It's always just more, like, into this classy scenario, you know, walk very classy people.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And it wants us to know that this is a sexy film about sexy con artists being sexy from the get-go. That's what you're going to get.
Yeah.
And there isn't going to be a subversion of that along the way. That is what the film is about.
Yeah.
And it's what I tend to deliver when I do my shows, you know,
yeah.
Is that a lot of time I'm delivering the fantasy of the con artist, not the reality. You know, it's the exaggeration, and that's what you see here.
Yeah,
it's another film that has Apollo Robbins, who's a great, fantastic magician, but he is every time you see his name on the credits, you know that it's a very specific type of very slick, very cerebral, but ultimately showy version of the con artist. You're not going to see him on a David Mamet film.
Yeah, no, he definitely, there was the scenes in it where they show pickpocketing. I was thinking that this is probably a detail that you really enjoyed about it, is that they're using all the lingo, which to me, I just sort of blanked and it all just washed over me because I didn't understand it. But I'm guessing speaking as a professional, you were quite... Were you impressed?
No. It was, imagine if... If you were the only person, you're one of the few people in the world who knew about cars, and then you heard someone talking about cars and said, oh, no, it looks like the carburetor's on the diff and the gears are on the wheels, and it looks like someone's, you know, reversed the engine over the spark plug of the exhaust pipe. And you go, what? I know,
really?
I know those words, but they don't really make any sense.
I totally bought into it. I figured it was all clear.
No. I mean, it was. I mean, they were all real words. It was all technically accurate, but it was not. It was the equivalent of someone, you know, just picking random words out of a con artist dictionary and saying them so fast that you sound like an expert.
Oh.
You know, like they used to do on ER, you know, like, or any of the hospital shows where they're just talking very, very fast, saying medical jargon, and you assume they know what they're talking about. Mm. You have no idea whether that's what a doctor would actually do, but you trust them. And it's the same. It's the same in this film.
Oh.
So for me, the subtitle of this film is Old Men Patronize Margot Robbie. That's what the film is about. You have your first old man is Nicky, played by Will Smith, who is the seasoned con artist, and he meets the inexperienced Jess, who played by Margot Robbie, in a hotel when she tries to scam him with an unsophisticated scam where he allows this, you know, this to be taken up to a hotel room, and then her husband bursts in and of course threatens him and wants money, and he sits back and
the scam from In Bruges was what I thought. Colin Farrell.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly, and a bunch of other movies.
Is it a common one in real life?
Yeah. It's called the Badger Game or the Honey Trap, and it's the premise is a guy, usually a married man, hooks up with a woman, and then the police come in. It turns out she's underage. Her father comes in. You know, her husband, a priest. You know, the priest. You know, basically an authority figure comes in and forces them to give up money in exchange for.
Or in this, it seems to be when they pull it off, it's just to leave the pants behind with his wallet in them.
Yeah, well, that was their variation. Was the person's meant to run off down the corridor with no pants on, and they leave their wallet behind. But you could probably shake them down for more money than that if you get them to the ATM. But
yeah,
anyway. So that's the scam, and of course she doesn't know what she's doing, and he starts patronizing her and telling her that, you know, let me tell you how it's done. I'll explain this scam. You know, I'm the expert, and he just straight away. He's just condescending, like he's just patronizing, and she's very doe-eyed, and he starts stealing her rings and her watch and her wallet, and she giggles inanely and rolls her eyes, and it's this. It reminds me of like those Chris Angel or David Blaine like street magic specials where, you know, you just have douchey magicians fooling, kind of, you know.
Yeah, I'd say
like,
that
like young women who then, you know, swoon and giggle at the sleight of hand of it all.
Yeah, I guess the difference is that Will Smith is genuinely very charming.
Yeah.
Like he, like you said earlier, Cary Grant, like unlike those Chris Angel guys where you sort of start to feel like you just want to shower.
Yeah.
He's actually seems to be doing it quite good-naturedly.
Yes.
The theft, which plays into the plot later on.
Yeah. And so he's teaching her how terrible she is and giving her some tips, and then, you know, sends her on her way. But again, a bit like Cary Grant. I mean, you watch those old Cary Grant movies where he was, you know, the ones he made in the 50s and 60s. Where he's,
well, yeah, Charade is the one, yeah, I always think of, where, yeah, it's him and Audrey Hepburn.
Mm.
And she has a line where it's just weird that she's like, I think, was she in her 20s at that point? Yeah, and she has a scene. She was always being hooked up with these old dudes because it was Humphrey Bogart in Sabrina as well. And yeah, she has a line where she...
Gregory Peck in Roman Holiday.
Yeah, yep. She says, you know what's wrong with you? Nothing. And it's like, well, I can think of at least 30 years.
Yeah, I can think of that, yeah. And it's not even the age. It's the age, but also combined with the vaguely the paternalistic way that they act towards her. You know, this kind of creepy fatherly way in which they interact. And it's that old thing you see again in those kind of Cary Grant movies of the old man saying to the beautiful young girl that he's going to kind of take her over his knee and spank her kind of feel. And that's what I got from this movie the whole way through, is that of her being...
Yeah,
a pawn in his games.
Yeah, look, he's in great shape. He's not, like, as a 50-year-old guy, he's in a much better shape than Cary Grant in the 50s.
Yeah,
or Gregory Peck either. Actually, like, he's, you know, he's not young. He's 48. You were saying.
Yeah,
but he's. But it's still noticeable that there's a status that they're clearly representing very different levels of status. Like, she's the ingenue trying out in the game for the first time, and he has all the power.
Mm. And it's, I mean, that is a trope of the con artist movie. Like, you know, like The Sting, it's exactly the same, but, you know, Robert Redford.
Nine Queens,
the same criminal, again, exactly the same. House of Games to a lesser extent.
Oh, yeah.
You know, similar sort of idea that it just...
Because it's audience surrogate. We have to explain how contracts work, so we're going to use these characters.
To explain it. And that's, I mean, that's what happens, is the movie then shifts to New Orleans, and we get the montage of a team of con artists all working together to scam as many people as possible in the shortest amount of time. And you get to see all of the little bite-sized scams that, in and of themselves, maybe one at a time and not that interesting, but as like a quick... Oh, I mean, they are, sorry. I mean, I think they're interesting, but from a viewer... They can say, oh, look, she's, you know, stealing a wallet with a pair of chopsticks, and now they're playing a game of cards, and the marked cards can only be read if you're wearing the correct contact lenses. Mm. Oh, and look, he just removed the face off that ATM that has a credit card skimmer here.
Yeah, that one I thought was great. I'd seen things with scammers, but I think it was just a little thing you put over the mouth. It wasn't like literally this guy pulls the whole front of the ATM off and walks down the street with it.
Yeah, and they do that. I mean, there's guys who would put the whole ATM. They'll just wheel an ATM into a shopping center, plug it in, put it in, and it'll say, you know, error. Sorry, spit out the card, but it's already taken your PIN and your...
I can totally believe that. You ever been in like a weird little convenience store and they've got a brand of ATM you've never heard of before?
Yeah,
I use it because I need cash at that point for whatever reason. But you're always like, you know, and there's like a weird like $3 surcharge on it. Nah.
Yeah. And you don't want to. Yeah. But I think audiences love, and I love that quick, that montage of just throwing everything they know. And it sets up the first scenes of the film with, you know, in the hotel, sets up their relationship. And here, this is just really, they just lay down the credentials of this guy. He knows cons and scams. And
yeah. And is it at this point where he goes to dinner with Margot after they've done their day of like pickpocketing and stuff, and he shows like his little con artist sweatshop where they sell all the stuff they've stolen and that, which is all presented as being, oh, isn't this impressive? As opposed to me, I was looking going, so do you like pay these women a salary, like the old ladies just sitting there filling through it, or do you like have their husbands kidnapped somewhere under gunpoint?
yeah. It was this. It reached a point where the crew became a sort of small scale operation, and there's like a sweatshop of people.
Yeah, it started to look a bit dodgier than maybe
credit cards and selling wallets on eBay. It
started to look like maybe some very important police are looking for this guy. Though that is a very big thing about this film. In Focus, cops aren't really a thing.
No,
Yeah, which is definitely a conscious decision on the part of the film to make it less, to make it seem more fun, I think.
And in fact, if you think about it, all of the, there's a kind of hedonistic free-for-all about, maybe not in the hotel scenes, but at, you know, this montage is all in Mardi Gras, and so you've got the brass music playing, you've got people out on the streets, and it's this kind of Wild West mentality of anything goes, and there's no law, and I think it works great.
Oh yeah, and it makes, and he explains how the people that he does that thing that so many con artist movies do, where they basically say that that obviously our targets are people who deserve it. You know, it's like guys who like cheat on their wives. Mm. That's what we're looking for. And there's a bit where the pickpocket guy says, "Oh, no canes, no wheelchairs, or something like that. It's bad luck." And I'm like, I'm not sure that all con artists would follow that rule.
No, that does. But I think a lot of these films are about finding the secret world of the con artists and being given permission to enter this group of people. But they're not really a group. You know, they're not really a group of people. They tend to be individuals, or there might be small groups, but they're not a community. They're not like, hey, did you catch up with Jim at the con artist convention?
It really does create them a sort of Robin Hood, but they keep the money for themselves kind of vibe.
Yeah. But that is, and it's something we've mentioned a lot on the podcast, that is the legacy of The Sting, which managed to find a way to construct a story in which the con artists are the heroes, and you can it's okay to go for them. It's okay to, you know, you don't have to worry about the victims of their crime because those people deserve it, and it's okay. And
so are there con artist operations this big that exist?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely. Really? Sure.
Because it's huge.
It's massive. Yeah. And but then it just sort of all disappears at the end. Like at the end of this long weekend, they all get together. Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, there are organized. You look at the Nigerian email scams that you get, they're not run by one person at a computer sending out emails. They're large-scale operations, and with employers and bosses and their own internal structures.
But I can see them work. I just never, like, these guys are running pickpockets and like, multiple honey trap scams. That's probably not real. No, that'd be like one-off person running it.
Yeah. Like, for example, you'd had in the 1950s and 60s, you had the Kangaroo Mob, who were a group of pickpockets who went to... They were from Australia, but they went to the UK. Uh-huh. And they would basically shoplift and pickpocket. And they worked as a team, and they had all the characters. And they were huge and made tons and tons of money. There's a great book by Adam Shand, the Australian writer, about them. And they didn't, you know, do a sideline in the shell game or any of those things. You know, they picked what they were good at. But yeah, of course, these operations definitely do exist. Again, it's about the fantasy of the con artist.
Oh, yeah. And it looks like they're extremely good at it and they could always get away with it. And then they get to the end of the pickup artist day. He and Jess have a really nice dinner. Do they go to bed together? No, he gives a separate hotel apartment.
Mm.
And then he comes to the apartment and then they sleep together.
Yeah, they do sleep together though. That happens.
Yeah.
That's, you know, when they seal that deal fairly early on.
Yeah.
And then this is the highlight of the movie for me, is the introduction of Mr. B.D. Wong, aka Nameless Scientist from Jurassic Park, who has a name, I think, in the Jurassic World. And also, of course, Law and Order. And Law and Order, everything else. He comes in with the most extraordinary cameo as a Chinese businessman / gambler. That just because, to be honest, by this point, it was kind of going, where's this going? Because we haven't had any, hasn't been any story yet. There hasn't really been any plot. They've met each other. They pulled some small scams. There's no hint of anything larger going on in the story. And then, boom, in comes B.D. Wong as a gambler who they meet in a corporate box at the football.
Yeah, and at one point in the night before, someone has said to Jess that make sure Nicky, the Will Smith character, make sure he doesn't gamble. Like, you guys are hanging out now, just keep an eye on him because I'm a bit worried. Make sure he doesn't gamble. So they go over to the football game together. This crazy Asian gambling guy sitting behind them, and he goads Nicky, Will Smith's character, into gambling on small parts of the game.
Yeah.
Like, what's the name for the thing where you're just going for, like...
Prop bets.
prop bets.
Yeah, little proposition wagers and side bets on, you know, it starts with, I think, like, is that guy going to catch that hot dog that's thrown to him? And is that guy going to stand up for the wave? And how many people are going to look at that woman's bottom as she walks away? And then there's a few things about the game come in and it gets bigger and bigger. And of course, and the money escalates and escalates.
And Jess is very worried because Nikki's just falling straight in. And he seems to, like, Will Smith seems to be really selling it. Like, he's really falling apart the more this guy goads him and the more he seems to feel that his ego's being insulted.
Yeah.
And there's a connection between earlier, he said how his dad was, you know, so... did he say it was his dad? Yeah, because that's how she found him. His dad was this gambler who pulled the Toledo panic button.
Mm.
Like, he shot his partner to get away. And who was his son? And so it's clear that this is a guy with a lot of macho, you know, grandstanding in his blood. And so there's a sense that he just cannot back down.
Yeah. And they end up
challenge.
Yeah, they end up gambling everything. All of the winnings. So it was $1.7 million from all of the small scams they've been pulling over the weekend. Get, you know, thrown down on this single wager. And the single wager is that... BD Wong will look out at the field with a pair of binoculars and choose one player's, the number on the back of one player's back. And if Jess, so it has to be Jess, can guess what that number is, then they walk away with all of his money.
Mm.
And lo and behold, she manages to guess the number correctly because when she looks in her binoculars, she realizes that one of the players on the sideline is wearing... is in fact
one of Nikki's con
one of right? Yeah, one of their crew, and she realizes there must be something deeper going on, and so she says 55, and he goes, oh my god, that is correct. And the reason why he chose the number 55 while looking at all of the players is because they spent the last 24 hours subliminally planting the number 55.
Yeah.
The tramp stamp of the prostitute they sent to his room was the number 55. The chandelier had 55 in it. The Chinese for five is woo, apparently. Yeah,
there was a protest about Proposition 55.
On his way there.
And he actually saw the con artist that ends up wearing the jersey in the car beside his one.
Yes, so he recognized that guy but didn't know why. So it was all this subliminal stuff was put in. And then she says, but how did you know that was going to work? And he goes, well, it was a 59% chance.
Better than Vegas.
Better than Vegas. And I would have just gone double or nothing about if it got it wrong. And it's like, that seems a little ridiculous. I mean, aside from the fact you cannot implant thoughts in people's heads in that way. Like, that's just not a thing.
So it doesn't work. Yeah, because I was thinking this is that neuro-linguistic programming stuff.
Which is bullshit, by the way. Like, it's neuro-linguistic program. I don't know how much you know about it. It is a collection of little psychological tricks that do work. On a high percentage of the time, which are then exaggerated into this vast network of, almost religious level beliefs of manipulating human behavior.
Yeah, I guess just like hypnosis used to be.
Yeah. Yeah, the one that I liked the most was the as I said, the word for five is woo. The Chinese for five is apparently woo. And the song Sympathy for the Devil by the Rolling Stones is playing, and that has woo-woo in it 138 times.
Yep.
So he kept hearing 5-5, 5-5, 5-5 the whole day, which was completely ridiculous and not a real thing. But
really? Oh, yeah. Okay.
It is. I assume the Chinese for five is...
woo, and that's the number of times it appears in
that song.
Sympathy for the Devil.
Yeah.
But that just wouldn't have worked to make him say
that. Make someone say, like, if I, you know, yeah, no.
Because this is the second time Will Smith's been the star of a film that has sold people on neuro-linguistic programming, because he was in Hitch.
Yes.
The first big pickup artist, of the new strand of pickup artists. The first movie about that, which...
Yeah, which is kind of nasty, weirdly nasty kind of movie.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay, I've got Google Translate has just given me the symbol for it. Let's see if I play it, what happens. No, I can't find out the Chinese for five. I'm sorry. I've let you down. But it is. Here we go. Woo. Yes, it is.
It does seem like a very big risk for him to take.
Mm.
Like, the thing... the real life story of a con artist that I can remember is I used to work with a lady and her brother-in-law was in prison because he and a friend were running a white van trick, which is the one where you sell people a set of crappy speakers from the back of a truck implying that they're stolen. And then the person like pays like $200 for them and then it turns out they're absolutely worthless. But the guy that he went with on the white van trick with decided that he wanted to make sure they were going to get money out of this scam. So he brought a gun with him. And when the guy tried to back out of paying for the speakers, he pulled the gun and like just made him give him his wallet.
Yeah. And this is
And so, yeah. So I was thinking like in real life con artists, if they're not, they wouldn't do a risk like that unless there was a second definite way to get money out of it.
Yeah. And the links between con artists and violence are, you know, very obvious and exist, you know, all over the world. It is not this honorable profession where they would never dream of hurting someone because they have honor. They tend to go more for fraud because they're cowards and want to avoid the direct confrontation. But they're not above pulling a gun, like you said, to get them. And that's the thing. The film they try and avoid the violent route and try to go with the seduction and the gentle persuasion and the
eyes. It's all just an intellectual game.
Yes. Yeah, that's it. And then for some reason, and that is never really made clear, Nikki just abandons Jess on the side of the road with $80,000 and says, so long, and leaves. And I do not know why.
This is the heart of the film. We can't go properly into it without touching the spoilers.
Okay.
But I was more interested in the possibility. I was disappointed in the film when it's revealed that Nikki is actually just pretending to be addicted to gambling. That was just set up so Jess would give a more believable performance when they're doing the bets with the Chinese gambler. Because when that actually kicked off, I thought that seemed like an interesting direction. Like, why is this very intelligent, you know, highly successful, charming man, why is he, you know, running these, you know, quite risky con games? And the revelation that, oh no, he's got a gambling problem. That's what's making him do it all. I thought that's a really interesting direction to go. And then the film goes, oh no, this is another con.
Yeah. Which is something that we see in I Love You, Philip Morris, is that the reason why he turns to fraud is because he's trying to live this extravagant lifestyle as a newly gay, outed gay man.
He thinks that in order to be gay, you have to be very, very rich.
You have to spend lots of money on things to be the sort of gay man that he wants to be, and so has no choice but to get into fraud.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. Whereas in this movie, it's all part of the scam. Which, again, it's something we mention a lot, is in these movies, you'll have a twist where it turns out it's all part of the scam, and it undercuts the drama and the emotion that you felt up until that point, because it didn't actually matter, because everything was under control the whole time, and we don't need to really worry about these characters. But at the same time, we now know less about them and maybe care a little bit less about them.
Yeah, exactly. It's this problem every time you have a story that has a lot of twists in it that is constantly undercutting its own emotional connection, is you run the risk of ultimately having told a story that was about nothing. Like the best example I can think is the Usual Suspects ends with it being that Kevin Spacey's character. I can spoil The Usual Suspects.
You can
spoil
The Usual Suspects.
That's fine. That's like the most...
Yeah, yeah, okay, yeah.
Cool. Rosebud's the name of the sled. And Kevin Spacey's made up the whole story from the board. And it's like, so it's possible that outside of the stuff that Chaz Palminteri, the detective character, outside of the stuff that he confirms at the start, it's possible the whole thing was made up.
Yes.
Like, it's possible we have sat through a 90-minute movie that was entirely bullshit, which is, from the point of view of the filmmaker, I think that's kind of a bad thing.
Yep.
Like, you may have just wasted everyone's time. In the same way that a story where it all turns out to have occurred in someone's head, or it was all a dream.
Well, that can work, though. I mean, that can work as a conceit
if you pull it away and something was more interesting was going on underneath.
Yeah. I mean, the example of, Fight Club, where it turns out large chunks of the film are happening inside his head and characters only exist in his head, it tells you something new about the character. When it's done in a con artist film or a crime film, all it tells you is a character you thought had one level of intelligence actually has a slightly higher level of intelligence. And that's all it really tells you.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, to me, the best twists in these kind of films are ones where that tell you something more about the character, which I think I love. We'll get to it at the end, but I love you, Philip Morris definitely does that. Mm. And then the final act. So Jess gets abandoned on the side of the road. We go to Buenos Aires and
three years later.
Yeah, 3 years have passed and they hook up. Nikki and Jess are reunited when it turns out that they're both connected to this same billionaire motorsports team owner, Raphael, who basically is trying to find a con artist to help with to help basically win a race.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter. He's trying to win a race.
He's trying to make the other team worse while they think they're getting better.
Yeah, exactly. There's a MacGuffin. There's a special program that's going to help but it's basically then you get a series of crosses and double crosses going on. But the focus of the film has shifts back to away from that scam and that con and onto the relationship between Jess and Nikki and whether Jess is romantically involved with Raphael. Nikki is trying to
is trying to continue the scam while ignoring the returning feelings, the fact that he really was in love with her 3 years ago when he abandoned her.
Yeah.
And I think they say in the film I think she accuses him or so. At some point, they make it very explicit that he abandoned her because he thought she was getting actually emotionally close.
Yes.
And there's a whole thing about you can't have heart in this game.
Yeah.
You know, like his dad shot his granddad.
Yeah.
You know, to get out of a con. That's how much this all means.
Yeah. And that's what you have to, and that's what you have to do. But and as it goes on, you realize that the film is not, it's sold as a con artist movie and it has all the trappings of a con artist film, but it's very much about the relationship between two people who don't really trust each other very much.
Yeah.
And who have every reason not to trust each other very much because they've both
Their
job is lying and they've both shown like a lack of, lack of goodwill to each other. And you realize as the film goes on that you're not really watching a con artist movie, you're watching a relationship drama because there's not a lot of comedy there and so when by the time we get to the twist, which we won't spoil, it kind of seems beside the point. What we really want to know is, are Jess and Nikki are they going to reunite, or are they going to come to terms with what their relationship is,
and do they actually genuinely care about each other?
I'm
not sure. I think there is an extra level that's revealed by the spoiler, but it's not
an important one.
Yeah, not an important one. No, and it. I'm trying to think my way around discussing the thing. Okay, but the second half of the movie is predicated on building that relationship, and talk about the car crash sequence, which is.
Oh,
I think my favorite part of the whole film.
Fantastic.
It's a wonderful
scene. I mean, the movie is really just a series of cool set pieces that don't really cobble together into a particularly satisfying plot or story. You know, the hotel is great, like nice little scene. The stuff in New Orleans with the montage stuff works well. Some of the car race stuff's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And the car crash is great as well. Yeah.
Yeah. No, well, the car crash, it really scratched that itch. There's a, I'm not sure if you talked about the director on the podcast before, because he tended to do films about small level criminals, Jean Melville, the French director.
Oh, yeah.
Who made films like Le Samurai and stuff. And even though this film's very, very slick and like high production and lots of fast cuts and everything, the enjoyment I tended to get out of it was like that thing of just watching a professional in action and like watching if you're going to try to kill someone with a car crash or incapacitate them so you can take them, just watching step by step how you go about that process.
Yeah,
it's
a good 10-minute scene in which you see this thug go into a shop and he buys a lot of
buys a mouth guard, a neck brace,
a helmet,
and you're trying to put together where he's going, like
what's he doing.
He goes and has his dinner, the locals are watching a game on watching a soccer match, he's kind of annoyed by the noise they're making, goes out, and it's just leading up until he's in the car and is just speeding down the street faster and faster and faster, puts the neck brace on, the mouth guard, and
yeah, and then smashes into the car holding Will Smith. And
what I'm saying is I would happily watch a whole movie of people who make money by causing car accidents.
That is a film. There's a great insurance fraud film from 2000 with Brian Brown and the goofy guy from Sea Change, Tom something, Tom Long, I think is his name. And it's all about insurance. And
Metal Skin?
No, not Metal Skin. I'll see if I can find the name. Not Dirty Deeds, but it's Risk. Yeah, it's a film. It's basically about a Tom Long, who, for international listeners, was briefly famous in the 90s, 2000s for his role as a kind of hapless, lovable schmo in a Sea Change, which is kind of a nice little drama. A nice little drama, patronizing.
One of our most successful TV programs.
Yeah. And so he gets in this film, he gets hired to basically go to the families, grieving families, and to convince them to take a small settlement on a car, car insurance payout. And because he's so lovable and doe-eyed, they tend to trust him. And often they'll sort of say, okay, you can't give more than $20,000. And he'll give them like $30,000. And in reality, it could have been at, $200,000 if it had gone to court. And of course, he then gets kind of wrapped up in this world of insurance fraud and with being led astray by...
And it's quite an accurate one?
It's a very accurate one. Yeah, but it's very late 90s, early 2000s. It's got Claudia Carvin in it. And as I said, Brian Brown's there. And it's set in Sydney. So it's very slick, pinstripe suits, kind of a real kind of Wall Street vibe to it.
Cool.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. But yeah, that's exactly what you're talking about.
So the mechanics of the con game in the film I found were quite enjoyable, and the film, when it focused on them, seemed to work quite well. The relationship thing's fine, because as much as the age disparity is there, they're both very charming people, Margot Robbie and Will Smith. So. Yeah.
And in their defense, this is what we have come to expect from Hollywood romances, is that you will get, a leading man who is twice the age of his leading woman. I think it might be an issue that you and I have reached an age where we are kind of halfway between...
we've become more forgiving.
Maybe we're just... I think we are smack bang in the middle between Will Smith and Margot Robbie, which isn't a nice place to be.
It's pretty...
In terms of age. Yeah. And I think then we've become a little bit more to hyper-aware of that age disparity.
We'll know we've reached equality when we can finally see the hookup movie between Jacob from Twilight and Tilda Swinton.
Yes.
That's the coupling that I want. She's a fancy con artist lady.
Mm-hmm.
All slick. God, that's a great movie. Oh, why did I say it on the podcast? Mine.
Tilda Swinton hooks up with Leonardo DiCaprio in The Beach when he was quite young. But I think she's only maybe 10, 15 years older than him. So I don't think that counts. Anyway, so...
Taylor Lautner.
There you go. All in all, though, there's not enough, the characters are not deep enough and the relationship is not satisfying enough, I think, to just rest as a relationship drama. And because the story of the scams and cons are also piecemeal and kind of patchwork together, we don't really get, it's like we get two fairly average movies put together pretending to be perhaps greater than the sum of its parts.
Yeah,
is that unfair?
Though I remember when this first came out, the marketing all focused on how slick and how fancy it was. And I remember talking to you about it, having seen the trailer, and saying, oh, I reckon I know what the twist will be. Just from because I figured it was going to be... this isn't screwing up the spoiler by saying it isn't this. No, but I figured it was going to turn out to be Margot Robbie was like a cop all along.
Yeah.
Or something like that. Because judging from the trailer, it was... and I think it's a more interesting film than that would have been.
Yeah. I think that's the thing, is that it tries to be more interesting than a regular con artist movie or crime thriller where it turns out it was all a scam. And it tries to be more interesting than that. But in rejecting all of those cliches and tropes, it fails to replace it with anything as satisfying. So let's move on to I Love You, Philip Morris, and we'll come back to focus as we're talking about it, because they made this movie 6 years earlier, and it's based on a true story, which is the first major difference between the stories, is that this all really happened. And doing research, it seems like most of the events play out as they did in real life.
There's a few things I've had to leave out because they're too weird. I can't remember exactly the ones, but I was looking at them and thinking, that would have, if I'd seen it in the film, I would have thought, oh, that's bullshit.
Well, that's what I'm with Catch Me If You Can. A lot of the stuff in Frank Abagnale Jr.'s memoir, it was too unbelievable to put in the in the movie. They've also changed a lot of the order of events. So they make Philip Morris is introduced into the story a lot earlier than he was in real life. But because it's about the relationship of these two characters, it makes sense. So the film also, I mean, it opens with Stephen J. Russell, played by Jim Carrey, on his deathbed, dying, and he looks sick, and he's dying in hospital, in prison, and he's telling us the story of how he got there, which does not bode well for a film when you have guy on their deathbed saying, "Let me tell you how I got here."
Yeah,
through long, intricate voiceover. But it just goes in. Within 10 minutes, you're going in so many different directions that you didn't expect. He's a loving family man with a, you know, he plays the organ at church. He's
a deputy police officer.
Yeah, it's great.
He works for a frozen foods company. Mm-hmm. No, I think the way the film structured is he actually was a police officer.
Yeah.
And it's revealed to him when he was a kid that he was adopted.
Mm.
And then as a police officer, he actually uses his contacts to discover his adopted family. And he goes to meet his real mum for the first time, and she doesn't want anything to do with him. And it's pointed out at that, which is true in the, which is in the real story as well. He was adopted out, but he was the middle child.
Yes.
The real story is his mum was divorced from his dad, but she was still pregnant to him, but she didn't want to raise the kid outside of marriage, so she adopts the child off, but then remarried the dad and had three more children.
Wow.
It's the, which is like you think adoption often makes people feel like they're unwanted, but he was so specifically unwanted.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, it sets this idea of him not being, feeling like a bit of a fraud from the whole film. He's set up as like, oh, you're not really a member of this family because you're adopted. You're adopted. Your real mother, birth mother, she's not really interested in you either. And his relationship with his wife, she's very, very religious, and he's clearly not as religious and is just going along with it.
Yeah.
To an extent, which is...
Yeah, he keeps trying to just go to sleep, and she wants to do more prayers.
More prayers and things. So it's straight away, he's clear he's a bit of a fraud. And then discover
that
the most brilliant way possible that he's in fact gay.
Yeah.
And you see him having sex, vigorous sex with someone from behind, and you can't see who it is, and their head pops up into shot, and it's a massive kind of hairy biker.
Yeah.
And they have this filthy exchange between the two of them, and then he climaxes. And if you haven't seen the film, imagine how Jim Carrey in any Jim Carrey movie would climax, and that's how he does it. And it's just, there's no subtle introduction of, there's no coy, like, I always knew I was different, and showing him, you know, looking at an ad for men's underwear and, you know, as a child looking at it strangely or anything.
Is it around this point, though, where they have the shot of him as a kid looking at up at the clouds and seeing dicks?
Yeah, seeing wieners fly past. Yeah. And so, bang, he's gay, and he's in a car accident. Another brilliantly shot car crash, same as in Focus.
Yeah.
He's just driving along, and he gets wiped out and says, I've survived this. I'm going to be honest. I'm gay. Comes out to his wife is gay. And within 10 minutes is living in Miami. He's got a beautiful boyfriend who, I don't know if you noticed, the boyfriend is the same guy.
There's a few actors. There's a couple, yeah. Between this and Focus.
Yeah. So his first boyfriend, Jimmy, is this beautiful Latin His beautiful Latin boyfriend, who's played by Rodrigo Santoro, who is quite beautiful. Mm. He plays Rafael, the motorsport billionaire in Focus. So he comes, he's in both. And there, he basically reveals that the great line of, I didn't realize that being gay was so expensive.
Yeah. And so he says that at that point he starts doing credit card and insurance fraud.
Yeah.
And in real life, in 1992... J. Stephen Russell, that the story's based on, that was the first time he went to jail, was for faking insurance fraud.
Yeah.
So it is, which I think is before the film set and says that he goes to jail. Yeah, and they're going around town and he's using stolen credit cards and he has multiple different driver's licenses to use with the credit cards.
Yeah, it's sending his ex-wife a giant pile of
money.
Cash. Yeah. One of the things I really loved about the movie was the relationship between him and the ex-wife, in that there's never any real arguments between them.
No.
They're always getting on. They're always, you know, even when there's tension between them, it's always, she's very understanding and he's always very upfront. He comes home and goes, I'm gay. And she goes, what? And then now he's gay.
Yeah.
And they just breeze everything else. And she's quite accepting of it, and she, you know, she knows about Jimmy, and
she gets frustrated, but she doesn't like, she's never really like yelling at him about any of it.
Yeah, although there's an awful line that she says when she discovers that he's also guilty of fraud, and she's talking to Jimmy, the boyfriend, and says, "Is this something that, like, is this a gay thing? Is this something?
Is the gay being gay and stealing? Are they like the same thing?
Are they part of the same thing?"
And Jimmy says, "What the fuck are you talking about?
What is this?" And from there, you know, obviously he eventually gets caught, gets sent to prison.
Gets caught. And this was my favorite joke in the movie, is the cut between he realizes that he's been caught, tries, like he said, don't worry, I had a plan. And it cuts to him swallowing a bunch of pills and vodka in the car.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. It's clear that he has no plan and no idea what he's doing, which is, I think, part of the humor of the film is the constant thing of this guy who is supposed to be a slick con artist, but is in fact highly emotional. He's madly in love. He's irrational. He's impulsive. And that's kind of what I think real con artists are like. They,
oh, yeah. You know, it's why people always say they like them so much. Like, even after they've been scammed, they're like, he's a really likable guy.
Yeah, that's exactly. And impulsive. You know, he goes to throw himself off a building to escape from the police. And, you know, brilliant stuff like that.
Yeah, and it's the likable tone and the kind of the comedy cuts from, like, him jumping off the building into what is apparently a perfectly safe dumpster full of things, into him just lying on the ground with a blood nose.
Yeah.
Because he's missed it. All that stuff's really important because the elements of this real life story are very depressing.
Like, yes.
There's a lot of darkness in it, and it's a big deal that these ex Angry Beavers riders, it's their job to sort of keep the mood up so you keep watching.
Yeah. There is part of me that feels like sometimes, I don't know, I'm the classic white, you know, white, straight, Anglo-Saxon, liberal, you know, smaller liberal, who is, you know, constantly worried about, wait, is that offensive? Is that homophobic? Mm. Because it did feel like homosexuality was used as a punchline a lot in the movie. Like, the introduction of the fact that he's gay is a big laugh of like, oh, look, it's Jim Carrey having sex with a man. Slap your thigh. There's a scene when he first goes to...
I suppose diving in with both hands is sort of better than like them doing it all with implication.
Yeah. But
like if they did it with implication, then implies shame about it. And the film is just proudly very gay.
They're, yeah. I guess the thing is that the gay, like all of the gay sex scenes are played for laughs. There's no... There's some dancing and a little bit of kissing that is...
But it's shown as quite joyful, whereas the one sex scene he has with a woman is shown as being...
That's true. You're absolutely right. It is joyful. I don't know. I'm sure that there are...
criticisms to be made.
There are probably criticisms, but they're probably... I was going to say, they're probably gay and lesbian scammer-paloozas. There you go. I used it. Who can chime in and say where they felt that it was a respectful... betrayal.
Yeah. Or whether, I guess the bigger question I had was whether there's a problem with it being two straight guys playing gay.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, is it gay face?
Yeah. Yes. I don't know. That sounds like something, sounds like an insult that you would call someone in, you know, year eight.
In 1992.
Yes. So he goes to prison for insurance fraud and is where he meets Philip Morris and they fall in love. And basically the rest of the film is their relationship and the various attempts of Stephen J. Russell to keep the them together.
Yeah.
And he does that the only way he knows how, by lying and cheating.
Yeah.
And that is the thing, because he has lived his entire life as a liar. So as a straight, you know, pretending to be straight when he is in fact gay. Even when he comes out as gay, he then becomes a fraud as well. And then when he meets, you know, Philip, he then continues to lie to Philip and for Philip in order to keep Philip happy and to keep them together.
Yeah. And I guess, again, as much as far as the realism of the scams that he uses go, they're like real life con artists. They're a lot simpler than the kind of stuff you'd see in a movie like Focus generally.
Mm.
There's a couple of really complicated ones that are based on real ones that Stephen J. Russell did, including stuff involving the final twist that I also can't go into. But yeah, like most of the time, it's literally just you steal a credit card from somebody, you pretend you are that person, and you take all their money. This isn't something that like has a, you know, a lot of fancy names for it. It's just a thing you can do.
But that said, what he is successful at doing is he's successful of playing the role of the person with the credit card. So, for example, he impersonates a lawyer and he just says, "I'm a lawyer now." And there's nothing complicated about that. He, you know, in the scam, he pretends to be a lawyer and uses his impersonation of being both a lawyer and a judge on the phone a few times to get Philip released from prison. And there's nothing complicated about that, but in the actions. But the complexity comes in the character and the way in which he's able to successfully influence people and to make them believe. There's a great scene where he goes into he's in a court case and he has no idea what he's talking about and goes into the chambers and says, you know,
just gets the judge to give him the...
Yeah, he says, look, you know...
The result that he wants.
Yeah, the judge says, look, what do you want? And he says, do I have to say it? And then stares at him and doesn't say anything until the judge says, wait, are you talking about... And then, and he goes, that's exactly what I'm talking about. And, of course, you know, wins the case. And it's that level of manipulation. I think that's where the complexity comes. In Focus, you have simple people pulling elegant, complex scams. In this... The scams are mostly simple. You know, I'm going to pretend to be a businessman and go to work and, you know, make lots of money. The complexity comes in the human, the way in which he interacts with other
and
people.
And he's also never shown ripping off a friend or a relative, which I think is that's a big deal because, in both of these films, like I always remember whenever you talk about cons, you always say there's no good target. There's no, like, one where it's perfectly ethically acceptable to steal. It's still theft.
Yeah.
But in this film, they just don't linger on whether or not someone's the victim of it, and they focus more on how, you know, the law will punish you for doing this.
Yeah.
And in Focus, they just don't, they go, everyone we're stealing from is an arsehole. They're cheating on their wife, or they're a violent race car driver man. And, so both of them... avoid the idea that no, that's someone's money you took.
That's the real victim. You never see the ramifications of the crime on the victims, with the exception of Philip himself, who it's in and out of prison. They get transferred, and he lies and you know swindles to get them reunited in various points. And at one point, he pretends to be a lawyer to keep Philip in prison.
Yeah,
and basically extends his sentence so that the two of them won't be separated.
Yeah.
And that's when you realize that he is doing it for himself because he loves Philip and wants Philip, not doing...
Philip, who is in the film, is very beautiful and this great object of desire.
Played by Ewan McGregor.
Yeah, who is a very beautiful man. It's no different to the watches or the house or the car. It's something for him to own.
Yep.
But then in the scam in the middle of the movie, based on the real-life one that Stephen J. Russell did, is both he and Philip Morris are out of jail together. And he got a job working for a bank...
As a medical management company.
Yeah, a medical management company. And there was this real-life scam where he took funds that were waiting for the transactions and he put them in to gather interest. And so a big chunk of the money he gave to the company to make it look like he was making them a lot of money. And then he kept a lot of it for himself. And he made millions. Like, it was a huge thing. And it amazes me that he was even capable of that. Like, that almost seems like maybe he could have just done the job. if he's capable of...
Yeah, and that's something you see a lot. Frank Abagnale Jr. is a famous example. Frank DeMara, who we've mentioned a few times, and there's a couple of great books about him. They take on the role of respected members of society, and they do it so well that you're left wondering, why didn't you just be that thing? What tends to happen with those people psychologically is that they say, I want to be a lawyer. And the way in which you become something is by labeling yourself as that thing.
Mm.
So you don't say, I want to become a lawyer, so I'm going to go and get a law degree and work very hard at being a lawyer. You say, I am a lawyer. And that's how you become a lawyer. And then everything else is just convincing the outside world what you already know. So I guess, does it
work the other way, where like sometimes people literally are lawyers, but because of a lack of confidence, they don't think they are.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So all of the times you've said, I really want to be a comedian, and then you've gone and cried in your room after a bad gig and said, I'm a terrible comedian, I'm a terrible film critic, no one cares what I think, and my jokes aren't funny. That's not the way to do it. I mean, look, okay, we both know comedians who have basically said, I'm a comedian, and they have stepped up on stage and been extraordinarily unfunny, but they have done that with such confidence and such almost belligerence in their own... abilities that the audience go, oh, they must be a comedian.
But
they must
a,
be funny.
In a way, there's a very big possibility that all there is to being a comedian is confidence. Like the only thing it is psychology, whereas being a lawyer, I don't think it is just confidence.
Oh, no, no, I'm not saying it's just confidence, but I'm saying that for these people, that type of personality, their brain doesn't say, how do I become a lawyer? Their brain says, I am a lawyer. Now all I have to do is prove it. So yeah, he could have gone in the regular route and become a lawyer, but that would have taken 5 years.
Yeah.
Why not just say you're a lawyer and then deal with everything else as it comes?
Yeah, there was a big one. I think Australia Post. There was a guy that worked for Australia Post in a financial position, and they found out he was innumerate.
Yeah,
like he couldn't, but he had the job for years, and apparently he was perfectly fine.
Mm.
But yeah, he could do the job if someone like explained to him, you know, how it all worked. But they eventually found out he had like a grade 2 level of maths.
Yeah, the person who was in charge of, who was the editor of, and this is probably not the most important job in the world, but they're the editor for basically all of the articles on religion for Wikipedia. And they were put themselves forward as being a professor of religious studies and having multiple PhDs. And everyone, anytime there was anything to, you know, any sort of skirmishes in the Wikipedia community about what should be, they would come to him and he would ponder on it. And he would then, you know, give his answer. And it turned out he was just some guy with a copy of, you know, Organized Religion for Dummies and, you know, The Complete Idiot's Guide to Buddhism. So
yeah,
I think there are a lot of jobs in the world that you can do for a certain period of time. With just bravado. And I think that's what Stephen J. Russell did. He just, you know, he was a lawyer and he just kept being a lawyer.
They've probably massaged it a bit for a movie. There's a chance that, like, even I think with the innumerate guy, I think I remember reading that, like, a lot of people would ask questions about, you know, he's not giving us the real information about this stuff.
Yeah.
But if there's enough people that are believing it, then it doesn't matter that you're not providing the right work or...
Yeah. That's exactly right, yeah. And our go-to is to just believe people, isn't it? Like, that we just believe them until they give us evidence otherwise.
Yeah, especially if they're doing a thing that we're not doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I just point... I've mentioned it a few times, but Maria Konnikova's book, The Confidence Game, which came out this year, and there's an audio book which she reads herself, and she sounds like one of those NPR reporters, so it's really classy, is an amazing book into the psychology of con artists and scams. She's a New Yorker writer, but also a psychologist. And she was on the podcast, and I lost my computer, crashed right after recording the interview. And it was one of the best. She was so intelligent, and I kept her on so long, she had to go, so I have to go now. Anyway, but you'll find out like more about exactly what goes on inside these people's heads. It's definitely worth reading.
Yeah, that book. No, I'd love to check it out because the heartbreak, the tragedy at the center of I Love You, Philip Morris is just that he's unable to connect with someone without doing these lies, without it still being part of a further scam. Like when he got off and he got the job at the medical place, he was just frankly bored with the idea that he could just live with his boyfriend and be happy. And Philip Morris himself, the object of his affection, is depicted as being kind of uninteresting.
Yeah.
Like when you spend a lot of time with them, there's a really lovely sequence where he's just eating these candies in their kitchen and just reading each little inspirational wrapper that comes with it.
Yeah.
And like sighing and sticking it to the fridge. Yep. Just one after the other. Like each one to him is just such a beautiful sentiment.
Yeah. And Philip Morris, the real Philip Morris, has said that the depiction of him in the film by Ewan McGregor is fairly accurate.
Yeah.
Like that he really does. He says, yeah, that's pretty, you know, like describes himself as a bit waifish and wishy-washy and not quite all there. And it was very, very happy the way in which he was portrayed in the film.
Because he is, above anything else, just a victim of Stephen J. Russell. Like, he genuinely is affected that someone would lavish that much attention, but then all he does is suffer.
Yes.
And just keeps being... he gets dragged back to prison because, of course, it turns out that he was never a lawyer all along, so the acquittal they got wasn't real and, like...
Yeah. There's an interview with him and he says, like, when he's asked in the interview, is there something he did in which you really saw himself? And he goes, I'm a ball bag, okay? I'm just a big old sissy ball bag. I cry a lot. I'm very sentimental, very tender-hearted, and that kind of thing. And the scene where Ewan, where I'm sitting alone in my jail cell and Steve is in hospital and the orderly walks up to my door while I'm sitting there eating crackers and I look up and say, want a cracker? I know that sounds silly, but the orderly never speaks to tell me what's going on in the infirmary. He comes through the door, but he doesn't speak, which says it all. I used to cry in my cell a lot. So he clearly has I guess the thing is, he is in the film. He comes across as like a bit nothing and a bit wishy-washy.
Yeah.
And wifey, but he also, I think this is in the film, he does have a sense of self-awareness.
Mm.
He does know.
And he wants to get very far away from Stephen after a certain point because he's so damaged.
Mm.
Yeah, and to Stephen, it almost, without talking about the ending, to Stephen, is it almost like the point of the relationship was Philip Morris gave him a goal.
Yeah.
Like it was something to always aim for, that they would end up together. But then he never does the same thing that would mean they'd stay together.
Yes.
It's more important that he's always just out of reach.
Yeah.
Then.
That's it. And that's, I mean, it's a far more interesting relationship than we get in Focus.
Yeah.
It's complicated and human. And maybe that's because it's a real story and it's a real relationship. But I think also, you know, as the case with biopics, they are kind of works of fiction. You know, they're not... They're
rearranged so it fits a better structure.
And the dialogue and the characters are not real people. They are, they're reflections of those people. And I think they just did a much better job with this movie.
I guess the main thing you do with a biopic, I guess, is you take, there's a period of calm and then a crisis undercuts that period of calm, crisis undercuts that. Whereas what life mostly is long periods of calm and nothing, then 400 crises at once and then boredom.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's it. Yeah. Like real life doesn't fit a three act structure.
Yeah.
And this film doesn't necessarily fit a three act structure particularly well itself.
The theory you said was that Focus is a romantic drama masquerading as a con movie.
Yes.
And I Love You, Philip Morris is a con movie masquerading as a romantic comedy.
Yeah.
But it's not even a romantic comedy. It's to me, I don't think, because it just doesn't fit. Like that's a genre with such a strict series of rules.
I don't know. You introduce two characters, you then keep them apart in comedic ways, and they try and get back together in as many comedic ways as possible throughout the film via a variety of misunderstandings and circumstance.
And then they end up together or they don't.
Yeah,
like Harry Met Sally or. But whenever I think of like the perfect structure of that kind of thing, not perfect, but like the clearest structure, the movie Starsky and Hutch with Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson was a film that was written like with each of the beats, like those two are not in love in the film,
no,
but they were given the complete structure of like at this exact point, they fall out at this exact point, they come back together when they first meet, they have friction. There's no real friction in this. Philip just sort of like, falls into Stephen's web at a certain point.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
It's a very, as a romantic comedy, it's quite threatening.
It is. Oh, it's very threatening. There's a real, and it's threatening, and a few critics called it mean-spirited because it for all its kind of joy and slapstick and
the tone, the very lighthearted tone.
Yeah, the very lighthearted tone. There's lots of shots of, you know, sped up shots of clouds against blue skies
every time a horrible thing happens, there's a song called "I Cried Like a Silly Boy."
Yeah,
that starts playing every time something really horrible happens, which is this kind of very upbeat indie thing that I think they're doing to don't get sad, don't feel bad in the cinema. Okay, this is a silly story about a very silly man.
Yeah,
it'll all be all right. No one's gonna die yet.
Yeah, but there's a sort of honestly it's okay. Nothing's terrible's gonna happen. No one's gonna die. But of course we keep cutting back to the increasingly emaciated Jim Carrey, who of course, you know,
I noticed the trick of him like lying.
We'll talk about
make people look thinner, you get them to lie in a bed and you just sort of sink the body in to just see the top half and put their head on the pillow and just get them to push back into the pillow so you only see the front part of their neck.
He is diagnosed with AIDS towards the end of the film, and that's obviously where we come in, that he's extremely ill and he's separated from Philip, and Philip is conflicted because he knows what a terrible person Stephen is now, but he also knows he's dying. And there's very, very touching phone call between the two of them in which he says, if you need to go, just go. And he looks out the window and sees his mother, from the very beginning of the film calling to him, and the single tear down the cheek. All of those things are there. So I guess by that point, because I got choked up today rewatching that scene. So, you know, for all its wackiness, it does still make you feel terrible for this guy who cannot tell the truth, who cannot keep his shit together, who escapes from prison in these ridiculous ways. But you still...
It's so hard to get to the head of someone like that because of all the lying.
Yeah.
Like, and he seems like with the multiple suicide attempts that happened throughout the film, like he seems to be someone who has a lot of trouble with being who he is.
Mm.
Like that he literally cannot keep everything together for long enough.
Yeah.
But it's frustrating from the filmmaker's point of view of like, how do you explain this person who keeps doing these inexplicable actions? How do we, you know, is it interesting for the audience to watch a man do something that makes no sense over and over and over again? The Informer with Matt Damon is a wonderful film. It's also about a pathological liar that about a guy who called the FBI in on his fellow people who work in the corn industry for price fixing. And the FBI investigate it, and they just find out that this guy has called them in because he says, oh, there's some wrongdoing at my company, has been lying and stealing from everyone for years. And they just keep finding out that he's lying and stealing more, and every meeting they have with him, he tells more lies.
Yeah.
And it's just, you're watching the film, and you just can't get inside this guy's head. You just want to shake him and go, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
Why are you... Yeah,
that is the story of the con artist.
Yeah,
is the person who continues to lie, continues to cheat, even when it's no longer in their best self interest to do it. They will keep up the lie. Yeah. I mean, there's other movies, you know, Owning Mahoney, which is another true story. That Philip Seymour Hoffman plays a bank manager who's continually defrauding his bank to pay for his gambling
problem. Yeah. But see, then there's a motive. It's like, okay, you've got a gambling addiction. That's why you're doing this. And in that film, it has the gambling addiction's portrayed as like, he just doesn't react if he wins or loses. Like externally, there's just nothing. He just does it compulsively over and over.
But that's the same thing. I mean, this is compulsive behavior with the compulsive spending, the compulsive lying, you know, the constant compulsive behavior that he plays throughout the film, knowing that
so it's like he's
self-destructive.
He's just addicted to it.
Yeah, he's addicted to it. There's a theory that the the con artists tend to fall within it's called the dark triad in psychology, which is narcissism, Machiavellianism, and psychopathy. And so it's the idea that you have one or more of those behaviors.
And in this, Stephen J. Russell, his epiphany is brought about, like his decision to live his life truthfully is brought about by a car accident, which would possibly involve head trauma, which is... In stories of like psychopaths and serial killers, is like the one fact keeps repeating over and over again. At some point in life, some point of head trauma. The film doesn't explain it as that, but I just remember as watching, like, I'm grabbing onto any reason I can to understand why this guy's doing
and
stuff.
And this is, I mean, we've all read John Ronson's The Psychopath Test, you know, like that. Like this, I don't know. I don't want to be...
People are diagnosing people with psychopathy all the time.
That's what we do now. We used to diagnose everyone with Asperger's. Now we diagnose them as psychopaths. That's like the new thing.
Because you're not supposed to say sociopath anymore.
Right? No, you're not. Yeah.
But, yeah, like, I'm trying to... I just can't come up with a reason for why this guy does it anymore than I... Because Focus, of course they do it. They're really good at it. They're millionaires.
Yeah.
They live in the Hilton, the hotel. Like, of course you would be a con artist. But if you kept getting caught, like, wouldn't at a certain point you find Jesus or something?
Yeah. I think that's the issue, though, is that it's compulsive behavior. I mean, like, it's we as humans are built on routine and compulsion and obsession and finding behaviors that we get linked into, and we do them all the time, and we repeat them again and again and again. And sometimes they're self-destructive behaviors, and it's self-destructive in the film. I obviously we can't speak for the real guy, but he is, you know. It's
definitely implicated that he's it's definitely implicated that when they've done... I read an interview with him, and he said, the real Stephen J. Russell, and you can probably look it up, but he says that they ask him about his mother abandoning him, and he says something very heartbreakingly understated, like, oh, I guess that did make me feel a bit bad.
Yes.
And that's so much worse than if he said, no, that was terrible, and that's exactly why I do this. The fact that it's just like, oh, well, finding out that no one really wanted me was a bit... That was a bit of a bad day.
Yeah, that did. Anyway. That hurt me a little. Yeah. And that's... But that's it, isn't it? That kind of lack of self-reflection is what... That's what you need to be a great con artist. It's not... You know, I mean, I don't think I would make a great real con artist, because I'm constantly thinking about how these things work and why they work and how I would fit into it and how I would do it. And a real con artist doesn't need to do that.
No.
Because they just do it and worry about the consequences later on.
Yeah. No, I definitely... The anxiety would kill me.
Yes.
Like, it's so... And it hurts Stephen J. Russell a lot. In interview with The Real Guy, he said that one of the reasons that he wanted to give up escaping, though let's not believe that for a second, but he said that, it, like, the anxiety of being on the run, like, he still has nightmares about being chased.
Yeah.
Even now. So, like... he would bring... his actions still brought the anxiety on. He was still scared of getting caught.
Yeah.
But I guess he was never scared until he was actually getting caught.
Yeah. We should mention just quickly a couple of his escape attempts. One was he got a guard's uniform and then a very, very loose version of it. But then by tapping the radio, got his hand on a guard's radio and tapped it on the window of the security booth, which he noticed all of the guards did. And was basically let out of prison because they just assumed he was an undercover cop or there was a reason, because he had a radio.
Stole a bunch of green markers because the workers in the infirmary had green uniforms, and he washed it. It's in the toilet in real life, apparently, in the sink. He mixed all the green markers with water in the sink and just soaked the prison uniform till it was the same color as the infirmary one, and walked straight out again. His real life scams are just outside of those conventional ones that he seems to have done all the time. Just the level of planning and everything involved. Though in prison, I guess he got time to do that.
Yeah. Another thing I noticed was throughout the film, there's often signs behind or next to people describing the exact opposite of what they're doing. So there's a prison riot, and Jim Carrey's standing there, and there's like just loud noise everywhere, and there's a sign behind him that says quiet. And another point, when he leaps off the parking garage, printed on the edge of the building, it says no jumping. and then he leaps off the building. So that, like, there's just those weird little incongruous moments throughout the film to just remind you that it's...
constant disobedience.
Just constant disobedience, yeah. Anyway, I absolutely loved I Love You, Philip Morris. I was really happy to see it again. The relationship between them is between the two men is real and sweet and believable and it is... There's often a thing in the way in which gay relationships presented on screen is that they say, well, it's a straight relationship. It just happens to be between two men and two women, and we'll just make one of the characters a man, and then that will make it accessible. Or you get the opposite, which is it's gay with a capital G, and it's making a political statement about what it is to be gay and lesbian, and it's being held up as like an archetype almost. Yeah. You know, like
This is about a relationship between two gay men.
Yeah,
they are gay men. They are not men who, for the purposes of this plot, have been coded as gay. It is about them.
Yeah, and it's about their unique experience, and which I think is refreshing, but also, sadly, probably the reason it didn't get the release it deserved.
Yeah, and they were saying that when they were filming in a prison, the warden of one of the prisons refused to let them film a gay sex scene in there. And it's like, that's where you draw the line, considering what happens in prisons?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. Can't complain. All right. So, we like I Love You, Philip Morris. We also liked Focus, but just a little bit less.
Yeah, no. One's a more conventional movie. And, yeah, both of them are a real good time. I was very happy with Focus.
I was very happy. You didn't make it.
just because you asked me to watch it and I had this horrible feeling because I'd seen I Love You, Philip Morris, that we were going to end up like begrudgingly going back to Focus every so often to describe this sort of hacky Hollywood movie.
Like it's an attempt to do something interesting. Yeah. And you can see that they have been inspired by, David Mamet and those.
Michael Mann.
Michael Mann, yeah.
Yeah.
Though, more complex crime thrillers. But it just doesn't quite work. So I think this is the moment where listeners should tune out if you don't want to hear the ending of the two movies, and we'll sort of spoil the twists of both.
Yeah.
And just sort of have a look at what that means for the overall film. So now's the time to turn off. You had your chance. So Focus, I mean, I don't even know what is the important part of the twist, because
it means a couple of things. One, he really was jealous that she was dating the racing driver. Like that whole thing about it was an emotional connection or whatever.
So what was the twist of Focus? Because there are so many twists throughout. It's like that by the time we reach the big twist, it's like, what do we care?
Racing one was a scam he was running with his dad.
Yeah. So his dad, so Will Smith's dad is in on it, and Will Smith's dad is the
racing driver's bodyguard. Dude.
Racing guard is sort of old misanthropic bodyguard, head of security, who's very menacing and brilliant. And even after he's revealed as the dad, is still menacing and quite brilliant. And is played by the guy who played the dad in the classic 90s television series Major Dad.
Oh,
he's Major.
I mainly know him as the rich dude from House of Cards.
Yes. Yeah. He's both. So he's in on the scam and helping run it, and he ends up shooting Will Smith in the chest as a callback to that.
The Toledo panic button.
Which is not a real thing, in which you shoot your partner.
It's a great name.
Innocent. But he shoots Will Smith because Will Smith is about to tell the truth and admit
that the scam has been between him and his dad.
Yeah, which is a stupid thing for him to admit at that point, because his dad is standing right there with a gun and can just as easily, like, the billionaire and the billionaire's offsider are both standing there unarmed. So he could, at the very least, pull his gun on the billionaire and say, "We're walking out of here."
Yeah, with the $27 million, because you wouldn't want to admit that you had a scam going with us in the first place.
Yeah, so we're going to go. There's no reason for him to shoot Will Smith like that at all.
Yeah.
But he does. And it's a big moment, and we think he's going to die, and he's not.
Yeah, my favorite thing about looking at that was I really wanted to ask you, Nick, if that was a common con man thing, and if this was something you did frequently on the weekend, shooting each other in the chest in that way, a specific way that won't kill you.
Yeah, we practiced that a lot. Yeah.
A true magician until you've collapsed a couple of your own lungs.
Yeah, I know a couple of guys who've done that. Like, I know some people who've shot them, done themselves some injuries with guns and arrows and, stab their
hand. Bullet
catchers and hand stabbers and all sorts of stuff. But this is, you had to shoot between the third and fourth rib at around 11 o'clock from the nipple, 1 inch from the nipple, and it'll be totally fine. He's not fine. He's shot square in the chest, blood coming out everywhere.
They have to Mark Wahlberg him from Three Kings.
Yeah, the gaffer tape and a thing in his chest and just the whole thing. And then he gets taken to hospital. The dad takes the money, but he says, "See you at Christmas." So it's kind of a joke. And Jess's big twist is it turns out she's not really seen the racing car romantically. And
she was just flirting with him in an attempt to steal his watch.
Yeah. Which, to me, reduces her character twist to being about her relationships with men.
Mm.
You know, it's like, oh, I'm not really with this guy, so I could be with you. Whereas his twist is more about money and more about the mechanics of the scam. And she's still just an offsider. And then
she's still not a great con artist.
No.
That's part of the disbelief at the end is, oh, you were just going to...
Just going to get a watch, that's it. Oh.
But as she points out, 200-gram watch.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm not going to get shot doing it. How about that?
Major Dad? Because this is the thing. Major Dad gives her this patronizing speech. Will Smith has given her several...
The part where apparently she was seducing him well...
Yeah.
I guess that was a lie all along.
Yeah.
Except maybe it wasn't, because does the twist mean that he really was jealous and upset and everything?
Yeah, exactly. But at the same time, none of this makes us care more or less for the characters, and none of it really means more or less for who they are going on, because they're already running off. They were running off together anyway.
Yeah.
With the money. The twist gets revealed. She reveals she was never really with him in the first place. Will Smith admits that there was the dad was in on the scam, and then they run off together anyway, but now he's been shot in the chest and the dad's stolen the money.
That's it. It's a very adolescent idea of romance, the one where the most romantic moment is when you've been shot.
Yeah,
that's exactly... It's what me as a teenager thought was the only time you could ever really tell a girl that you liked her. Yes. If you'd been riddled with police bullets.
Yeah, and that's when you do it. Yeah. There was a nice line. He did have a nice line of dialogue. He says, I want to tell the truth. Like, I want to be telling the sort of lies where
telling my wife she looks good in her jeans.
Yeah, that, you know, I'm, you know, I want to tell white lies. I'm sick of telling these dark lies. And he's getting a bit emotional. But even so, it doesn't. I felt like the film only had a twist because it's a con artist movie and it had all the trappings of a con artist movie that would have a twist. So they needed to put one on there.
And the big difference between this and I love you, Philip Morris, is like, he's not driven by compulsion.
Mm.
Like at the very end, they just underline this is just work. We are just very good professionals doing a job. And that's less interesting than if he was unable to not do it.
Yes. Now, I love you, Philip Morris, on the other hand.
I
knew the true story, but I hadn't read the true story in about a year when I first saw the movie.
Mm.
And it just hit me. The whole final 20 minutes of the film when he's slowly dying of AIDS and he's trying to make amends with Philip over the phone, and he's meeting with the doctors and they're doing blood tests and he's emaciated and it's horrible. And like I said, and he says, you can go now. And then the twist is that he faked AIDS.
Yeah.
And he faked AIDS in the real world. And he did it by starving himself so that he lost a lot of weight and paying someone to falsify his medical records. And they never did an AIDS test on him. They just did a bunch of other tests that pointed to him probably having
fucking
AIDS.
Texas.
Yeah. And he just points out how ridiculous it was that he got away with it at all. And he did it so that he... And even OD'd on medicines so he would go into a coma for 4 days and be... And they think he was going to die, so he would be transferred to a care facility, at which point he then rang the prison and said, we want to transfer him into a trial.
Yeah.
And then faked his own death, like faked his death certificates, which is relatively easy to do, to fake death certificates.
Compared to changing medical records inside the prison.
Yeah, but he did it all, and he did it all. And so after this whole thing, and you see Philip Morris breaking down when he hears that he's died... And then he just shows up and goes, guess what? I'm not dead. I'm still here. Ha ha. Hooray.
And then they have the extra pullback and reveal that, oh, I knew how to fake AIDS, because earlier on in the film, it's implied that when he got caught the first time for all the fraud, that his boyfriend broke up with him.
Yeah.
But it's revealed that that wasn't his boyfriend breaking up with him. While he was waiting to go to jail, his boyfriend, the first Hispanic boyfriend, Jimmy, died of AIDS.
Yes. Yeah, and that was the, Jimmy basically died of it, and that's how he knew how to fake AIDS, which is heartbreaking as well.
Yeah, no, it's good, because if the film didn't have that extra twist, it would be like, no, you piece of shit.
Yeah.
You're just a terrible person.
But he's using the death of his partner to, escape from prison, using that information.
And get back together with Philip Morris again.
Philip Morris is pretty, yeah. And there's a whole scene where he says, you're going to meet the one. And that's meant to, you know, and that's, you know, I'm not the one, but, you know, so don't worry about me dying. You're going to find the one, but treat him right.
Yeah.
And the final scene is you know, we sort of find out that Philip Morris is sentenced to a total of 150 years
yeah.
in prison for the multiple frauds and the multiple escape attempts. And the final scene is him running through the yard trying to escape.
Once again.
Yeah.
And with a giant dick in the sky.
Giant dick in the sky. Again, see this thing of like dicks. They're funny. Like people are attracted to them. What's wrong with them? That's, you know, that's the...
Yeah.
That kind of weird subtext that just made me feel a little uncomfortable.
Again, if only one of us was gay, so we could properly judge whether that's shitty or not.
No, I refuse. Yeah. I will only have straight white men aged 25 to 35 on this podcast.
Yeah, no, I've read the manifesto.
Read the manifesto.
The ending still provides... It gives the film an extra level that the twist ending for Focus doesn't. It doesn't mean that the film's meant nothing. It doesn't mean that it's just been lying to us all along. It's just a further thing that to this guy, the scam is always the point.
Yeah.
That's always going to be what drives him. But seriously, like the sentence they gave him, I'm guessing it's more for the escape attempts.
Yeah, it's 43. It was 43 years for the fraud, but it was multiple fraud, like again and again and again. Like it was, so it racked up. It was a repeat offender, and then it was 99, I think, years for the attempted escapes because it's just over and over again. He spends 23 hours a day in solitary confinement, and
he has one hour to shower
and exercise and eat, and that's it. And he's just. Oh,
they interviewed him in prison and he said, oh, I'm not going to escape anymore. He says, you know, I still have nightmares about being chased.
Yeah.
But he always escaped on Friday the 13th, which was Philip Morris's birthday. And they ask him in the interview, so when is the next Friday the 13th? November.
Oh, that's right. Cause that's actually in the, in the film, they zoom in on they zoom in on a calendar and it's Friday the 13th when he dies, which is when he escapes.
Yeah.
Which, if you think about it, means that Philip Morris found out that Stephen J. Russell was dead or thought he was dead on his birthday.
What a dick.
What a dickhead.
Except Friday the 13th isn't a birthday. It's just like one day in the year.
Hang on.
But he was born on Friday the 13th. Oh, he was born on Friday, so whenever Friday the 13th was in the year.
Okay, I'm glad this is pre-recorded so I can edit
every
out
year.
My lack of knowledge of Friday the 13th.
No, because I'll make you look better by this comparison. Like, I don't know whether we get a Friday the 13th every year.
Yeah, we must.
Do we?
We do, yeah.
There's enough months.
It's in the Constitution. Look it up. Do you know that Halloween has never fallen on Friday the 13th?
Bullshit.
Never. It's never. Do the math.
Because it's October
30th. Yeah. Yeah, okay, cool.
Oh, my God.
Oh, well,
wow,
on that note,
this is the least intellectual one of your podcasts.
No, think about that
as
classic Nicholas J. Johnson scam.
Oh, my God.
Almost got you to believe that Halloween was could potentially be on Friday the 13th. Where can people find you if they want to find you?
I am on Twitter as Martin Dunlop 1. Mm-hmm. I run a website called Nihilisticals. Which is me writing stupid comedy lists.
It's very funny. You should check it out.
And I do movie reviews for Web Wombat.
Great. Well, thank you very much for coming on Scamapalooza.
Cool.
Friday the 13th. This has been Scamapalooza. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au.